Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome. I'm Kelly Richards, CEO of the All Access Group and your host for All Access Radio. Tonight's guest on the show is Greg Estes. Greg is the VP of Enterprise Marketing at NVIDIA, which for two decades has been a pioneer in the field of visual computing and the art and science of computer graphics. Prior to joining NVIDIA, Greg was the VP of Marketing and Client Services for Moses, a startup providing a mobile platform for music labels, sports teams, and consumer brands. And prior to that, Greg was the CMO of Avid Technology, and earlier in his career was VP of Worldwide Marketing at Silicon Graphics during his many years there. A sought-after speaker and writer, Greg's been published in a variety of trade journals. He's been a presenter at a number of conferences and appeared on many TV shows, including The Oprah Winfrey Show, which I hope we'll have a chance to talk about tonight. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Hey, thanks, Kelly. I appreciate being on.
Great to have you. For our listeners, another little-known fact that I have to share is Greg is one of my longest-standing colleagues. We've known each other here in Silicon Valley for over 30 years, and we're still pretty young, so that's a long time.
Yeah, since kindergarten, I think it was.
Yeah, pretty much. So Greg is a trusted colleague and friend. We share a real passion for entertainment and technology, and our lives have interwoven in those arenas many times during those decades, including with Moses and Silicon Graphics in terms of our formal affiliations. So, Greg, just to get us started, having a trusted advisor is pretty important, as I'm sure you'll agree. And I wonder if you would be willing to share with our listeners who some of your mentors have been along the way, and I'm certain you've mentored others. Maybe you could talk about that experience.
Yeah, I definitely have had people in my life that have had a huge influence over my approach to business and how running teams and indeed mentoring others. I don't know that I've ever had sort of a formal mentor, but I have been very fortunate to have some really great minds share their time with me, and it's something that I make a real point to do for others. There's not many things that I get to do that I enjoy more than working with young people as they're coming up in their careers and doing whatever I can to be helpful to them and give them the benefit of my advice. I know when I was coming up, I got to work with some people like Dan Vivoli, for instance, who I worked with at both SGI and also here at NVIDIA. And I learned a lot from him about, you know, positioning and customer centricity and how to run teams and how to have fun, you know, within your organization, but also keep people focused. And I also had Charlie Steinberg, who was the president of Sony Broadcast, somebody that maybe your listeners might know. He was really great in giving his time to me over my career, and I learned a lot from him, up to and including things like how to be an effective board member when I had the opportunity to have some board seats and you know, just kind of existing at the executive level. So I think having a range of mentors who can help you in kind of the day-to-day challenges that you have, and then also maybe some folks who are older and more experienced and farther along in their career that can help set the northern star for you is really important. And again, when young people give me the opportunity to do that for them is something I really cherish.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Greg. Well said. And you know, well, these interviews are somewhat timeless, I like to believe. I am going to interject that we lost one of our own as Greg and I are taping this show today, longtime colleague and friend of mine, not as long as Greg, but close, named Dave Goldberg, who had been the CEO of SurveyMonkey and the spouse of Sheryl Sandberg of Facebook. Dave, the reason why Silicon Valley is being hit so hard by Dave's passing, his untimely passing at the age of 47, is that he was, in fact, a rare and very generous leader and mentor and friend to many. And I think that it's something that I'd be remiss if I didn't at least pause and mention during our time together, Greg, because in the end, that's what our legacy is how people remember us and what kind of value we offered in our limited time on the planet.
That's so true. So much more important than, you know, getting that report out or writing a great press release. You know, that lasting legacy that some people like Dave and others have been able to leave is, you know, it's what it's about, like you said.
Yeah. So we're going to talk some about your work, of course, Greg, but I also love to ask about some of your personal passions. Of course, I know what some of them are, but our listeners don't. And perhaps how they have informed the unique lens and trajectory that has framed your career and your view on your work and on the world in general.
Yeah, certainly. I've been playing professionally. If professionally means you get paid to do it, I've been playing music professionally since I was 14 years old, and still try to sneak out for a gig here and there. So that's been the center of my life and what keeps me grounded. I often joke that I see myself as a musician with a day job rather than a marketing executive that happens to know how to play the piano. So,
right.
You know, I think that keeps me where my priorities really ought to be in terms of being grounded.
Well, and I also framed the career path you've had to a certain extent, in terms of the choices you've made, even in working in technology. And you've somehow been able to squeeze in the angle on the music side, certainly during your time with Avid and DigiDesign. That was true.
Yeah, and you know, something that I think everybody can take away is if you can somehow have your passion and your work coincide in some way, then, you know, magic happens. It makes going to work that much easier, and, you know, you have that many more brain cells that are on the creative side around what you want to do. You're thinking about it. You're engaged in it in a non-traditional way, maybe, which helps you get to some good new places in terms of your work life as well. By the way, Kelly, you probably already know about this, but maybe not all of your listeners do. There's a good book on the subject. I probably will get a word or so wrong in the title, but it's basically Everything We Know About Business We Learned Playing Music. An author out of New Orleans, Craig Cortello. It's on Amazon and all the normal places. And they profiled me in that book, but a lot of people who are a lot more interesting and important than I am in talking about how playing music and being in bands and things like that has really shaped their business life. And it turns out it's a very reoccurring theme. It's often, and I know you know lots of folks that, you know, are venture capitalists or other, and they're off playing in bands and things. And it turns out that kind of experience can really shape you in terms of applying some lessons in teamwork and leadership that you get out of the organized chaos that is playing in a band.
Well, and I also think just at a brain level, people that have been exposed to music tend to do better in math and certain kinds of logic. It informs how our brains work. And in fact, I think I shared this with you previously, Greg, but I do believe that at one point there was this wild study that, you know, a disproportionate number of people at Apple during my years at Apple were musicians or drawn to music.
Oh, yeah. It was the same at SGI, too. And, you know, I would guess most leading, you know, Silicon Valley and tech companies, you have a vast disproportionate number of musicians. We just see it again and again and again. So, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. There's definitely something to it.
To be sure. Well, I don't want to miss out on our listeners getting to hear about the Oprah experience. So let's slip that in, and then I'll shift the conversation in a different direction.
Well, that was pretty fun. It was a long time ago. It was in the late 90s, but that's at the time was when morphing was just, you know, kind of starting to happen. And one of the best things was the movie that Oprah was really into at the time was Babe. And they wanted me to come talk about how you make pigs talk. And the night before, Universal called and they talked to the producer and said, yeah, you know, we're not sure. We want you to kind of go on there and sort of ruin the magic. We were laughing because I'm pretty sure that Oprah's audience was aware that pigs don't actually talk, and there was, in fact, some visual effects involved in it. So we straightened all of that out. But it was a pretty cool experience. I went on there to talk about visual effects and how they do all of those things. And you know, they flew me out to Chicago and did that whole experience. And
it was
great fun.
Those, you know, bucket list type items, and you can cross that one off the list, of course, especially since the show's no longer on the air. But pretty cool.
Yeah, it was funny. People said, well, you know, did you videotape it? I said, are you kidding? My mom has beta VHS, 1-inch, 3/4 U-matic. You name
it's
it.
It's probably even in Cal.
Yeah.
Well,
and
CK. Now, talking about special effects and production, that does take us back certainly to a lot of your work at different companies, and we might as well segue right into your current role at NVIDIA. I understand that there's some new technology, NVIDIA's Quadro GPU, that was released last fall, and I'm curious how that has changed or is changing the production process for high-end media and entertainment companies like Pixar, for example.
Well, we have Quadro's actually been around for a long time. We had a new version last fall, but the Quadro brand's been around for a decade or so, and that's our professional graphics processing unit. So what those GPUs do is essentially accelerate more than, I guess it's about 125 now, different media applications. So if you're doing video editing with Adobe or Avid or something, or if you're doing 3D animation with one of the Autodesk products like Maya or 3ds Max, having our processors in your system, the computer uses those processors rather than the CPU to make the special effects go faster or be able to let you animate and interact with more complex scenes. So because of that, we're used by more or less 100% of the studios that are out there. And, every year Quadro is, behind the scenes in all of the nominated films for visual effects, and we're very proud of that. But the thing that we're working on and trying to do more and more of is to give the artists who are, creating their visions an opportunity to use this, great increase that we have every year in computing horsepower to be able to interact with things that are more physically real and have correct lighting and the right materials and all the things that typically an artist wouldn't be able to look at until they got a render back, hours and hours later. They send a job off to a render farm and then they get a clip of film back and say, oh, the shadow's wrong.
Right.
On there, and then they have to start all over again. Pixar's spending in particular, they'll render a frame for 70 hours. So it's just a massive amount of computing horsepower that's needed to do this. So what we're working on is putting more of that power in the hands of the artists so they can sit there and they can do that lighting in real time and they can see what hair and fur look like. And Pixar's been probably the most recognizable name and leading customer there, but you have really every studio is off working on their own leading edge rendering capabilities, and we're working very closely with all of them, and it's just a great fun part of the business.
Well, to be sure, and again, a consistent theme I would say throughout your career. Certainly that held true during the days of SGI and MIPS and your work with Avid. It does seem to be a thread that has been reasonably consistent, although the horsepower keeps increasing.
Yeah, it does. But that's the part of the business that I'm drawn to historically. I gravitate to it because I love it. I'm not jaded by it at all. It's just still great fun to be part of the movie-making process. And I'm responsible for a lot of other things as well and some very important work, like people in science helping to cure cancer or doing weather forecasting or a lot of things that affect people's lives. But
sure.
I must admit, I'm drawn to the media and entertainment side more than anything.
It's no surprise to me, but I have to punctuate that for our listeners. Now, I understand that Gone Girl is the first movie shot entirely in 6K and that it was powered by NVIDIA technology. Why has this been called groundbreaking, Greg?
Well, for for people in the industry, 4K resolution, in other words, 4,096 pixels, has been the norm for a few years. You're starting to see 4K to pop up in consumer TVs and whatnot, and it's really difficult to get 4K content in your home today. It's possible, but it isn't necessarily widespread. But in the production process, 4K has been around for a while. So now you have a few people who are looking beyond that to 6K resolution. So it's, you know, just dramatically more pixels and dramatically more storage and more processing power that's required to work on it. But the reason that David Fincher and the team wanted to shoot in 6K for Gone Girl is not to produce a higher resolution video. That's something that isn't maybe well understood. The reason they did is because what they did was they shot on this 6K canvas, and then they were able to take a 4K or sometimes 5K image from the middle of this. So imagine panning around a larger image, and they could frame the shot exactly as they wanted to, and then they would take that and they would turn that into normal resolution. So really, really interesting work there to not use high resolution to just get more pixels, but rather to get the field of view that they wanted to get to set the mood in the scene. And they were quite happy with the results.
So more so in the production process than in the consumer experience.
Right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right, yeah.
So how does the cloud fit into all this, Greg? And did you see Google's actual cloud parody? That was pretty
good. No, I haven't.
That's worth watching. It's just a real geek type funny gag. But anyway, I would like to hear your reaction to the cloud part of the question.
Well, I think the idea of having an artist tied to a specific machine is a temporary phenomena. You know, we'll look in future years and maybe even laugh at the idea. I think in the future, the device that you're using, whatever it is, that you interact with your content, that device won't be the determining factor on how fast your application goes or what apps you can run on it. It's just a device, right? All of the computing horsepower will be somewhere else, and it kind of doesn't matter where.
Right.
And you'll be able to use, you know, whatever you like of whatever kind of consumer device you have and interact with it with a Wacom tablet or your finger or keyboard and mouse or, you know, a 3D space ball or whatever you want to use. And all of the horsepower will be delivered to you via some kind of video from somewhere else, and it'll come back so fast to make it appear that that application is actually sitting on that device and that the content is actually on your device. But of course, it won't be. You're just watching really fast video come back to you, and that's so liberating. You could be sitting kind of anywhere on any device running any application, and that really changes everything for the creative process, you know, to be in the flow from wherever you want to be.
And obviously liberates the participants from having to physically be in a given location, which is critical.
Yeah, and you said participants plural, which is the right way to think about it too, because if you and I want to collaborate on something, let's say we're working on Gone Girl, right? To just reference what you brought up, the huge digital database that you have to have when you've got all of this film in 6K, it would take hours and hours and hours to move it from Hollywood to, let's say, Singapore or something if you wanted to work on it. Well, if you can keep the data in one place, but the artist can be wherever they want and you never move that data, well, now suddenly you and I can be collaborating on it and I'm in Austin and you're in Vancouver and somebody else is in San Francisco or Singapore or London or wherever they are. And it can all work in a way that it just can't if you're trying to move that data around.
All right, so I have to do a throwback machine, Wayback Machine reference, because it is 20 years ago, and you and I will know this, some of our listeners will too, that this kind of reminds me of the Sprint Drums Network concept.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. None of this is particularly new in terms of vision. There were people like back then with Sprint and the whole drums thing. They've had the vision for a while. I think what's been holding the idea back of having everything be virtualized is that you didn't have enough bandwidth to be able to deliver that. And from our standpoint, there wasn't enough graphics horsepower in the cloud that anybody could figure out how to virtualize it so that you could then stream it out to the user wherever they are and have that level of interactivity. So these things have largely been solved now. There's still some work to do, of course, but you know, you're just on the cusp of being able to do this across a very wide range of applications.
Yeah, and of course this has been, I have to pause and do a sidebar here. This has kind of been a consistent theme for content creators in our world for decades. You know, they are visionaries. They have the vision for what they want to do, and sometimes the technology just isn't ready. Now, it was in the case of, say, Jurassic Park, when we were working at Silicon Graphics with Spielberg, but James Cameron, by contrast, had a vision to do Avatar a decade prior to when it finally came out, and or maybe even longer, and did not have the horsepower to achieve what he really wanted to. And sometimes you have to wait for the technology to catch up, no matter how many creative ways you try to jigger what you do have to work with. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely, and that's one reason why we here at NVIDIA spend a disproportionate amount of our attention on Hollywood, because they do have leading thinkers. They are looking beyond visual range. And they can see hard problems. They have a need to solve hard problems that the other markets will eventually catch up to. So
yeah,
we get a higher value out of entertainment. And also the U.S. government types, you know, it's kind of funny how, you know, it's sort of Hollywood with the guys with green hair and three nose rings, and then the CIA or somebody, you know.
Well,
this
has been going on since Star Trek for 40, 50 years now, right? The tricorder may yet become a reality. But
yeah,
things that were conceived in Star Trek 50 years ago are finally becoming a reality.
It's true, because there are certain markets, entertainment's one, and the intelligence community is another one, that they need to accomplish something that nobody's ever done before.
Right.
And money isn't really the issue.
It's
not
that,
about
first,
the money.
First, you have to conceive of the possibility.
That's it. Yeah, absolutely.
So that's where I think the common threads are. But it is interesting to watch those trajectories that have been consistent, you know, and just waiting for a better, faster mousetrap.
Yeah.
Now, I'm thrilled to see and note that you have been publishing some blogs for the last couple years, and specifically at blogs.nvidia.com under Greg Estes. You recently wrote a blog post about the growing problem of death rays associated with the new generation of glass-sheathed skyscrapers boasting computer-designed curves, like the London walkie-talkie building, which recently melted part of a nearby car. Can you expand on that a bit, Greg, and what you had in mind with these so-called fry scrapers?
This is like one of the most fun things I've ever worked on. So it turns out that there is a particular architect who designed both what is fairly universally known as the walkie-talkie building in London. It's on Fenchurch Street there. And also the Vidara Hotel in Las Vegas, which exhibits the same behavior. It's curved in such a way so that it creates, from the reflecting glass on the outside of the building, it's curved in such a way so that when the sun hits it, it acts as a parabola and collects that sunlight, and at an exact moment in time, it will concentrate that and then send that greatly amplified light down to a particular point on the street below. And in
kind of like a pinhole camera back in the day.
Exactly, focusing it in that way. And on the 26th of August, 2013, this happened, and it came down a street away, and it melted parts of a Jaguar there. And we did a pretty intricate simulation on it and found that it got to be more than 450 degrees inside that Jaguar. And the point being is that with this new rendering technology that we have, the product is called iRay, and it does path tracing, which is a particular form of ray tracing. And it's able to calculate exactly how every light, every shadow, everything interacted with all the materials around it. And if they would have had these tools, then they would have been able to simulate and know that this was going to happen. But they haven't, and it's occurred in probably a dozen different places. If your listeners want to have a little bit of fun, just type death ray into a browser, and you will find out that's in art museums in Dallas and Los Angeles, and you know, all over the place. There was a patron at the Vidara Hotel in Las Vegas, where the death ray is focused at the pool area there. He got hit by it, and he said it felt like he had chemical burns. It was so bad. This demo that we've done, it's a really interesting way to show something that's really important, which is now using this new technology, architects and others are able to visualize exactly, they can predict exactly how light will interact with a room, with the materials, with glass, with outside, you know, what in whatever solution, and they can alleviate these problems or use it to the greater good.
Of course, in the case of that walkie-talkie building and the car melting, you got to ask yourself, how did they figure out that that's what the cause was?
Oh, yeah, you should see the photographs. There is a beam of light that comes down off the building that is concentrated it looks like a death ray coming right down on this particular spot. And it's very visible to the naked eye. As a matter of fact, even after this happened, for quite some time, people would take, like, they would fry eggs out there and do all of these other things. So, it was pretty clear to the naked eye that what was causing it.
That's amazing. So with regard to NVIDIA Iray, what does it mean to have physically based rendering for everyone, and what are the implications of that?
Well, what we're trying to do is to make it so that if you're a designer and you could be making cars or you could be making, you know, felt tip pens or, you know, anything in between. What you want to do is you want to have a design on your computer screen, and you want to know that when you really go make it, it's going to look exactly like it does on the screen. So in the case of the building, they didn't know exactly how light would interact with it, and it caused the death ray problem. But an easier to grok example is, imagine if you were designing a new car, you would want to know if you had a tan-colored dashboard and the windshield was at this particular angle, if the sun was coming out of a certain area, will that cause glare or not? Because if you found all of that out after you had tooled your car, you would have to start all over again. And so,
you bet.
Whether you're designing a watch or a chair or the inside of a building or an atrium or a car or any one of a number of things, large to small, you want to know that when you go to build it, it's going to really look like that. And the only way to do that is to have physically correct lighting, in other words, doing the ray tracing calculations in the right way, and have physically correct materials, because you need to understand, have the computer simulate how that material will absorb or refract or reflect the light. And so we're putting a lot of work into this whole area of physically based rendering, and we think it's going to be the next big wave in computer graphics and really change how design works, because if we can arm that artist or the architect or the animator, whoever it is, with the ability to see that interactively instead of finding out later on, well, it really changes everything. So we're putting a lot of focus into it.
To be sure. And I understand that the U.S. Department of Energy has enlisted NVIDIA's help in building two GPU-enhanced supercomputers to accelerate scientific discovery. And so for our listeners, it'd be helpful to understand, what is exascale computing, and how does this plan figure into it?
So supercomputing is... There's a lot that goes into creating a system that not only can you do a lot of calculations, but to do that without using so much energy that it costs you hundreds of thousands of dollars just to keep the machine running. So the U.S. government and also foreign governments have been investing a lot of money into how can we build something that can do an exaflop, a billion calculations a second, but to do it in a way that is green is a little bit of an oversimplification, but it gets the point across, right? To use the least amount of power possible and to be able to make it so that it is, you know, it's very energy efficient or as energy efficient as possible while meeting the computing needs of you know, the future. And so the Coral system, which is next generation system coming from the U.S. Department of Energy. They do a wide range of things on there, but a lot of it is, you know, doing calculations for how nuclear energy will work, but also, you know, other types of energy, really of all kinds, from, you know, how gasoline engines can be made more effective all the way out to fusion and other areas. And then they also have time that's available on these systems for other kinds of scientific work of all kinds. People, you know, apply to be able to use that. So the overall point is to try to build the most efficient supercomputers possible and then to make this massive calculation available to different types of scientists to be able to, you know, advance technology across a pretty wide range of disciplines.
Absolutely. It's pretty powerful stuff. What are some of the theoretical possibilities once exascale is reached?
Well, you know, there by its nature, I don't know that I'd be able to be able to say exactly this and exactly that, because the nature is to be doing theoretical work on a variety of things, but certainly new energy sources that don't exist today. Also, you know, other practical things. One of the things that we're super interested in that isn't necessarily part of the Coral program but is part of kind of the next generation of high-performance computing is this area of deep learning. It's sort of a branch of machine learning, which is kind of a branch of artificial intelligence, if you will.
Right.
And we've been doing a lot of work around that, and that's the kind of thing that will show up in people's lives, and they don't even know it's happening. Like an easy example, and you might not call this deep learning per se, but it is an example a lot of people can relate to is Shazam. You know, when you're able to take your mobile device and have it listen to a song and have it immediately come back and tell you what song you're listening to, well, there's a lot of GPU horsepower that's out in the cloud to do those calculations and to go
and
through that.
And very fast, I might add. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. And then, you know, we're not able to talk about it, but there are other services, for instance, being able to speak into your phone and have it give you directions or understand what you're saying and come back with answers or other things.
Well, isn't that what Siri does, for example?
Well, again, I wasn't going to go into any specific.
Okay, we're not going to acknowledge anybody specifically, but there are technologies
right.
like that out there.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
And Siri's one example, and there's other examples too. But that idea, right, these next generation cloud services that you may not even think about them as being
yep.
cloud services, it could be things as simple as you are taking an application and you're posting your photos on there and you put your high resolution photo up there, but it shows up in a very low resolution thumbnail in your feed of that social media application that you're working. Well, there's a lot of work that has to be done to turn a lot of images from a lot of people from that, you know, to do the resizing of that or to do transcoding of that. And so there's massive computing power being deployed today against these services. And again, that will show up in your life and is showing up in your life without people even thinking about the fact that there's supercomputing power behind it.
Yeah, and kind of the last question along those lines is that given exascale is believed to be the level of computing equivalent to the human brain at a neural level, is there any part of you that hesitates in this race? I mean, do you think this kind of tech achievement will only enhance or could it complicate life as we know it?
Well, you know, you'd certainly like to think that we are smart enough to deploy this kind of technology in the right way, but we're also smart enough to know that there's bad people in the world that can do bad things.
Yep.
But it is pretty exciting to think about this next generation of deep learning and what it can do. For instance, making it so that you can train your car to be able to know when there is an object about to walk out in front of you and to know,
mm-hmm.
You know, that's not just a shadow, it's a woman with a child in a carriage or something. And there's other things, like, for instance, looking at hundreds of thousands of images pictures of coming back from breast cancer results and being able to have the computer learn and know and be able to identify whether that spot is or is not, in fact, a cancer cell at a higher degree of accuracy than the best radiologist can.
Or pathologist,
so,
yeah.
So
yeah.
So these types of things, I think, are maybe not what people typically associate with this deep learning capability.
Well, all the way to whether there's life on other planets.
That's right. That is right. So anytime you can train a computer to start to understand from a series of images to teach itself about what's going on in there, there are many very, very helpful applications that you know, it is not overly dramatic to say it will save lives.
Yeah, that's pretty powerful. So you're doing great work, Greg, as you have always done throughout your career. But it really is great to hear how passionate and enthused you are about working on things that are making such a difference across all kinds of different verticals.
I certainly enjoy what I do.
No, I think you've always sort of been very lucky and very wise in the choices you've made throughout your career. But before we wrap up our time together, I do like to ask all my guests what I feel is pretty much the most important question, and that is, you know, if you had a crystal ball, what comes next for you as part of creating your legacy beyond what you've already done, which is impressive enough? Is there one project or passion that you've not yet embraced that you dream about creating in your time remaining on the planet?
Well, I'll give you two completely different answers. One is something that I would love to poke into more, which is to take some of this computing horsepower and to turn it into to be even more focused on audio and music, virtual instruments that. You know, can simulate and replicate nuances in a way that is just not possible today when just, you know, sort of playing back samples in an intelligent manner, which is how it's done today, or using this processing to do, you know, convolutional reverbs or other things to create very specific spaces and to move into virtual reality, but in the audio domain as well as we can do in the video domain. So that
kind of reminds me of the Animusic stuff. Remember that?
No.
I'm going to have to show that to you some point. Animusic, computer generated animation video album, complete with just animated musicians.
Right.
Very cool, fun stuff from quite a while back, but it's kind of a Back to the Future thing again.
Yeah, so that, you know, that area of turning this horsepower that's available for science today into something that affects the arts and just in general, I would love to poke into more. And then the second answer, I'll take this all the way back to the very beginning of this conversation and say, you know, as I think about what else I'd like to do with my career, I meant what I said earlier, that one of the things that I enjoy the most is mentoring other people, helping other people to achieve their goals, you know, working with other companies on, you know, helping them to get the benefit of whatever I picked up about marketing over time. And, you know, as I, you know, once I'm finished doing this and thinking about how, you know, I want to spend the rest of my time, just consulting and mentoring and working with people on that just seems super fun to me, and I'm quite certain I'll enjoy doing that.
Well, and you're quite good at it, so that's a triple threat, excellent combination. And I would like to wrap up our time together by going back to the beginning of the conversation with regard to Dave Goldberg. I mean, again, I think the measure of a life well lived is how you're remembered by your peers and your colleagues and your friends. And the man lived a phenomenal life. The way I look at it, I've been privileged to know you for all these years, and consider you a friend and a colleague. And I see that you've created a great legacy that you can be proud of too. And I'm just grateful that I've got so many wonderful friends and colleagues in my life like you. So I guess I'm feeling a little nostalgic today in the wake of Dave's passing, but I just wanted to close that out because that's the kind of stuff that really matters, more so than ship horsepower, you know?
It sure does, and
yeah.
I appreciate your kind words, and I do think you're right. It is about what we can do for others. It is about how we can be helpful to others, and in the end, that's going to be the legacy that we leave for people, not some project we got done, and that's the important thing.
Exactly right. So, Greg, I know how busy you are. Thanks again for making the time to join me today. It's been wonderful.
Absolutely, and thank you so much for having me as well. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. And I always like to thank our listeners. We'll hear you again next week on the next edition of All Access Radio. Good night, everybody.